This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with Tom Haynes, AOPA Editor-in-Chief and Senior Vice President of Media, Communications, and Outreach. He's been reporting on the recent rise in aircraft insurance premiums, and we learned the reasons for that and how the increases can be mitigated. In the news, we look at the U.S. Department of Transportation, NPRM, for service animals on flights. Delta's solution for transporting your pet in a GPS-tracked luxury carrier. The Boeing 777X first flight. And vision-based flight control for general aviation. Plus more on fuel dumping and some good airline stories from listeners. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 588 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert. Hi, David.
Hey, I'm still blushing after last week. Thank you to Micah and Max for that humiliating but lovely sentiment at the end of last week's episode. If you haven't heard it yet, go listen to it. They put into a lot of effort to make sure that I was completely red-faced for at least several days, but I really appreciated the thought.
It was fun. It was fun. Really, most of the credit goes to Micah, but we had fun doing that. All right. Also with us is Max Trescott, host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's a CFI of the year, and he's an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Hey, Max. Shockingly, I'm here at home, which is kind of nice. So we've been on the road a lot lately, mostly flying the Vision Jet around the country, which I'll be doing again tomorrow. But in the meantime, it's great to be home for a day.
Excellent. Excellent. I need to get hooked up with you somehow and get into that airplane. I don't know. We'll have to arrange that somehow at some point this year.
We'll have to make it happen because it is one cool airplane.
I love it. All right. Well, our guest this episode is Tom Haynes. He's the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association Editor-in-Chief. He's also Senior Vice President of Media, Communications, and Outreach. Now, Tom manages a staff of 35 writers, editors, graphic artists, photographers, videographers, event planners, communications experts, and support personnel. Now, he earned his pilot certificate in his late teens, logged more than 4,000 hours. He has a commercial pilot certificate with multi-engine, instrument, and seaplane ratings. I love seaplanes. And he holds type ratings in the Eclipse 500 and Cessna CJ business jets and has a second-in-command type rating in the North American B-25 Mitchell. How cool is that? And he owns a Beech A-36 Bonanza. Now, Tom oversees the publication of AOPA Pilot Magazine, which is the world's largest aviation magazine. Also, Flight Training Magazine. That's a magazine specifically for student pilots and flight instructors. The weekly AOPA ePilot electronic newsletter. Also, the Flight Training edition of ePilot, AOPA Online, and the association's Video on Demand channel, AOPA Live. Now, Tom is often sought out for his publishing and aviation expertise. He speaks often at regional and national publishing conferences. He's appeared on news shows at NBC, CNN, and MSNBC. He's been quoted in the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, Business Week, and many other national publications. He's also regularly asked to comment on aviation podcasts and radio shows, which we're doing right now. So, Tom, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thank you, Max. It's great to be back with you guys. I'm exhausted now after hearing all that. Somewhere in there, I guess, I was born. We could start back there, too. But anyhow, thank you for that wonderful introduction. And, 35 staff members, although it says that I manage them, but I think it's really the other way. They're managing me. It feels that way.
Now, I didn't realize that you led such a large group of people, although on reflection, I guess it makes sense given the number and breadth of the media properties you're involved in. Are all those people AOPA employees?
Yes. Yeah, those are all staff members.
Fantastic.
And we got them scattered all over the country.
Sure.
most of them are here in Frederick, Maryland, where I'm based, but we have folks in other parts of the country as well.
Excellent. Well, Tom's been looking at some changes in the aviation insurance sector and how that's impacting the premiums that pilots are facing. And we're going to talk about that in some detail coming up. But first, we've got some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
All right, first up, from the Department of Transportation, the U.S. DOT seeks comment on proposed amendments to regulation of service animals on flights. Yes, we've talked about service animals, emotional support animals, probably almost forever. And the U.S. DOT has announced they're seeking public comment on amendments that are proposed to its Air Carrier Access Act. That regulation on the transportation of service animals by air. So there's an NPRM out, Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. I think everyone listening to this is pretty familiar with that concept. And this is titled Traveling by Air with Service Animals. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. The public comment period is open. They are specifying a 60-day comment period on the proposed changes here, although I have heard that one or two organizations is trying to see if they can get that extended to 90 days. But all the concerns, the complaints, the kinds of things that we've also read about, talked about, heard about, the DOT has also been hearing those same things. And they've been hearing it for people with disabilities, from airlines, from flight attendants, from airports, various transportation stakeholders, and just general members of the public. So this, I think, has the the possibility of being kind of an interesting period of comments, because so many people have so many different thoughts on service animals and emotional support animals. And I'll just comment, too, that there's a difference between support animals and emotional support animals. And a lot of the articles in the press seem to be mixing the two together at times. But what are your guys' initial thoughts on this NPRM and what the DOT is proposing?
Boy, I think this whole area is a poster child for regulation. I mean, lots of folks are not, you know, big fans of government regulation. This is one where I'm like, yes, bring it on. I think there are so many issues in this area that, you know, well-considered, carefully written, well-thought-out regulations are overdue. So yeah, all I can say is three cheers to the Department of Transportation. And boy, I would love to send my comments, but I don't think I'll need to. I would imagine they're going to get thousands of comments.
Yeah, no doubt. And in from a variety of different perspectives, one of the things that the NPRM proposes is that a service animal would be defined as a dog. That's right, just as a dog that is individually trained to do work or perform tasks for the benefit of a person with a disability. Another interesting aspect that they would no longer consider an emotional support animal to be a service animal. Right now, the DOT considers emotional support animals, ESAs, to be service animals. There are some other requirements here. That there's such a thing as a psychiatric service animal. And I don't think we've ever used that term before. I don't think we've ever run across that, but that would be categorized as a service animal. And it would also allow airlines to require forms developed by DOT attesting to a service animal's good behavior, certifying the service animal's good health, and if taking a long flight, attesting that the service animal has the ability to either not relieve itself or can relieve itself in a sanitary manner. I know that's been a problem on some flights.
It's tough for anybody to do that on most airliners these days.
I
mean, come on. Can we have a place to sanitarily relieve ourselves?
Yeah.
It's true. We used to complain about not being able to do that in GA aircraft, and now you can barely do it in commercial aircraft as well. One thing that kind of surprised me here, they're talking about limiting the number of service animals so that a person with a disability could only bring two service animals. Mm. Boy, I hadn't realized that people have been bringing, you know, two, three and more service animals. That's a pretty big loophole.
Yeah. How about flight attendants around the world, or certainly across the nation, are enthusiastically applauding that Department of Transportation is stepping up on this one, because I know that they are challenged lots of times, particularly with what some people consider the emotional support animals, and the things they bring on board are difficult for the flight attendants to manage. So I'm sure they'll welcome some regulation around this.
Well, I think the airlines have been in between a rock and a hard place, because they really can't challenge most of what people are doing without opening themselves up to some type of lawsuit. So their policy pretty much has been, okay, look the other way and let people do what they want, unless they just really go overboard and, you know, bring on their, service boa constrictor or something like that.
It's really unfortunate. The emotional support animals have been the animals haven't been abused, but the privilege has been abused by so many people. I mean, that there are people who really need an emotional support animal. And unfortunately, there's a lot of other people who've made it unfortunate for the people who actually do need it now to, you know, that they're having to spend more time justifying it when people who are bringing on their emotional support hedgehog. You know, it's just unfortunate that we've actually, you know, again, I hate to say it, but I hate when we have to regulate common sense.
Mm, yes. And there's a certain amount of that in here. And airlines have some discretion, or continue to have some discretion, under this proposed rulemaking. For example, airlines would be able to continue to require that service animals be harnessed, leashed, tethered, or otherwise under the control of its handler. I know we've had some animals running up and down the aisle. It would continue to allow airlines to refuse transportation to service animals that exhibit aggressive behavior and that pose a direct threat to the health or safety of others. It also allows airlines, if they want, to require that service animals fit within its handler's foot space on the aircraft.
Well, let's see. Does that include all 4 feet for the miniature horse? Whose foot space are we talking about?
I know.
Or the standard poodle.
Yep.
I just never been able to understand why miniature horses, though they might make terrific emotional support animals, it just seems like it's a little overboard for an airplane. Now, last year in August, the U.S. Department of Transportation also issued what they called a final statement of enforcement priorities regarding service animals on flights. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes, too. But it notes that airlines can't require advance notice for service animals, but they can require advance notice for emotional support animals. Also, that airlines can require both emotional support animals and service animals to require a lobby check-in. Now, more recently, Max, we see that Delta has a new service that they're offering.
Yeah, I found this a few days ago, and it kind of struck me as interesting, and also it kind of dovetails with this kind of regulation we're talking about. This is an alternative. So instead of bringing your pet on board with you, you now have a service from Delta, which will have a GPS-tracked luxury carrier for $850 per flight. I can imagine that this is a really great solution. People will be very happy that their animal will be tracked and won't get lost. The description of the carrier makes it sound like it's really really excellent solution in terms of providing, you know, food and water and security for the animal, and of course also the tracking. But I think the problem is the cost. You know, at $850, I think a lot of people would say, the heck with that. Let's see if I can get Fido to qualify under the now more restrictive service animal requirements.
Yeah, at first, thinking about the concept and relating it back to what we were just talking about in the first item, it seems like the basic problem is we have a lot of folks who bring their pets on board and have found a way to do that. because putting the pet in the hold is in the cargo is not as attractive as having it there with you for some pet owners. So a potential solution or type of solution besides regulatory solutions is to make it a lot more comfortable, a lot more safe for the pet to be in there with your luggage. And so, I mean, this would seem to do that. You know, these are insulated carriers. This is done in conjunction with a company called CarePod. And carriers, like I say, are insulated, so they protect against temperature fluctuations. There are multi-layered windows and doors, get this, with specially angled blinds to help create a calming environment, they say, for pets by blocking out the visual stress. There's a hydration system built in there with water, and they have GPS tracking. So, you know, there's an app for that, and you can monitor the condition of your pet from your device. All that maybe would make some people more likely to take that route for traveling with their pets. But at $850, probably nobody in basic economy is going to avail themselves of this little service.
Well, I think the irony, I was just realizing there have been occasions where I have paid for first class tickets here in the United States that were less than $850. So, I mean, you could theoretically buy a first class seat for your animal for less than that amount of money.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Or more to the point, you could fly United and not guarantee the pet will arrive alive.
Oh, David.
But I guess that could happen with any of the airlines. I mean, to be fair.
Yeah. I did look at the device online. I got to tell you, it looks kind of like a glorified milk crate. So they defined it as luxurious, but I don't know. Like I said, it looks kind of like a milk crate to me.
Wow.
A milk crate with GPS.
Right.
Fortunately, we probably don't have to track our milk quite that accurately.
All right. So we'll have a link in the show notes to where you can find the NPRM. So if you'd like to participate in that conversation, as we've said many times before, the NPRM process, I think, is pretty effective in terms of collecting comments from the public. Although, again, when you submit a comment, the comments are available to the general public. And so there's identifying information. So just, you know, think before you type. But if you do have some thoughts on this subject, please take advantage of the NPRM comment period. All right. We had another milestone. Boeing 777X completes first flight. This is from AIN Online. And the 777X has finally started its flight test program. They're hopeful for certification in 2021. And what we see here is WH-001, the first of four flight test aircraft. And that Boeing 777-9 completed a 3-hour, 52-minute first flight over Washington State. Finally, we see that airplane up in the skies. And I think probably Boeing needed maybe something positive, and this could just be exactly that.
It has folding wings. And for some reason, the airliner community in the world thinks that that is like the most amazing effect ever on an airplane. Not that they've ever been around like naval aviation for like the last 100 years, but
yeah, yes.
I have to admit, it's a very long and big airplane. It definitely, the fact that it's replacing a 747, which has much more elegance, is kind of frustrating, but it is a really long airplane.
It is. It is. The Dash 9 model has seating for over 400 passengers, range of just under 7,300 nautical miles, I think. And of course, this has these giant GE9X engines on them, which were actually a source for some of the delay. GE had a problem with the wear clearance on a stator vane in the compressor.
And a what?
Huh? The stator vane? Oh, do we have to explain? Okay. No, that's fine. So you have a compressor, right? You know what a compressor does.
It propels my airbrush.
Yes, it compresses the air for your airbrush. And the way that the jet engine compresses that is there are a series of progressively smaller blades that rotate. In between each row of blades is another row of airfoils that they call stators because they don't spin. The blades are spinning, the compressor blades, and the air coming off each stage of the blades is redirected by the stators, by the stationary airfoils, to impinge on the next stage of compressor blades at the optimal angle. So clearances inside these kind of devices is pretty tight, as you might imagine, because you don't want air leaking around. And so there's various ways that the rotating parts are designed to keep the clearance where it should be. And sometimes, you know, when you start operating an engine, a newly designed engine, you have these kinds of issues. So they had to redesign this particular airfoil in the engine, and they've done that. So, these are the largest engines, I think, anywhere. They have a 132-inch fan, which is just, ginormous. And within the cell, the engine's wider than a 737. Big engines, 105,000 pounds of thrust each. But we have a video that documents this first flight. And the nice thing, one of the nice things about this video, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes, is that it shows more detail of that hinge assembly than I'd seen before. Now, maybe people who are following this more closely have seen that, but the hinge assembly looks pretty robust to me.
You mean the wing fold?
Yes, sorry.
The thing that we've been doing all these years that the airline industry has discovered is a way of reducing the space of a wing in a confined area. Yeah, that, yeah, okay.
That thing, yes.
Good checking.
And these wingtips are 11 feet long, each of them. So when they're folded up, I guess that means you've got a 22-foot narrower width, which allows you to park the thing at the gate at airports. Boeing has about 309 firm orders to this point for the 777X. The customers are, it's kind of as you might suspect. Emirates has 115 on firm order. Next up is Qatar Airways has 60 of them. Then we're down to around 20s. Cathay Pacific has 21. Singapore Airlines has 20. All Nippon Airways has 20. And Lufthansa has 20. BA's got 18. And then there's 10 more, if you do the math, that are unidentified customers at this point.
Wow. So I don't hear any of the majors from the United States as customers.
No, not to this point. It's very much Middle East and Asia related.
So it kind of sounds like an A380 substitute.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think at the Dubai Air Show, didn't Emirates cancel their A380s and to buy more 777s?
Yeah, and A350s are the two that are kind of stepping up to. They're not as large as an A380, but I think they fit the mission better. All right. This is an interesting piece. This comes from Inside Unmanned Systems. And normally this would be something that David and I would talk about over at the UAV Digest, but it's got a GA connection here. And we see a Zurich-based startup, Dedalian, which is spelled D-A-E-D-A-L-E-A-N, Dedalian. And their mission is to build a certified airworthy autopilot that can also pass the exams for human pilots. Dedalian and Honeywell are collaborating on vision-based flight control for not only general aviation aircraft, but also for eVTOLs. And the software is autonomous flight control. They use vision-based navigation and terrain guidance and landing. Now, the company, Dedalion, was founded in 2016 by a group of engineers who worked at companies like Google and SpaceX. David, I see that their systems are on the Volocopter that we've talked about before. So the two companies have entered into a technological and financial partnership looking to develop a fully autonomous AI pilot. Of course, everything's AI these days. AI pilot for GA and urban air mobility. So what do you think? We can ask the two pilots, Max and Tom, what do you think about a GA aircraft with a fully autonomous AI pilot?
So it seems like, we're certainly beyond the point where, technology is definitely leading us from a flight standpoint where we are definitely to the point where you can have an autonomous airplane. I mean, it's now the psychological part that we've got to get over. And people need to come to terms with the idea that maybe there is no pilot sitting up front. But from a technology standpoint, I mean, look at what we've been doing with big drones, like the Predator, for example, has been out flying autonomously for many years. And the flight control systems are very sophisticated, take off, land, go fly a mission, come back and land in all kinds of weather and interacting with other aircraft. Talk to guys in the military and in places like Baghdad. And they're like, yeah, their manned airplanes are in the pattern with Predators, for example. And they're all just flying along and everybody's sequencing just like they're supposed to. And so clearly the technology is there. And under this new deal between these two companies, they're adding, obviously, even more sophistication, either bringing in visual components and artificial intelligence to even make better decisions. So it's getting better. But I think the hurdle here is not the technology. It's definitely the psychology of the passengers and the people on the ground.
Yeah, I think we're in agreement. And it also occurs to me that there are different markets for this kind of technology. Folks like yourself and Max, their pilots, maybe won't be that interested in this. I mean, a lot of the appeal of being a private pilot is flying the airplane. And if it's just a cabin that you climb into and push a button and get to where you're going, I think for a lot of people that takes away the thrill of it all and the interest in it. But then, there are other people, and maybe this is more the UAM, the urban air mobility, side of the space, where people who don't have any interest in actually becoming a pilot can use the technology to provide a convenient mode of transportation.
So, Tom, what do you think about AI for GA autopilots?
Well, the autopilots we have today are unbelievable. I've flown, as you may have too, the Autoland system from Garmin. It's obviously not a completely autonomous system, but it certainly can do, figure out the best place to land given weather conditions, terrain, and a bunch of other issues and come back and find a runway and land the airplane. And that's out there today. We've flown it. I've flown it a couple of times. And so I think by the time you add, visual components that they're talking about and helping it make better decisions with the AI component, the idea that we need a pilot, I think, as I said earlier, is probably behind us. Now, I think there's going to be a place for those of us who love to fly airplanes to the ability to do that for a very long time to come. And I've talked to some rather well-off people who look at the eVTOL world that are going to be featured in UAM. And they see those as something they want to acquire for their personal use. So they look at going out and buying one of those things and having it on days when they want to fly, that they enjoy that. But when they're commuting to work, they want the ability to just push the button and have it take them to work autonomously. So I think there's going to be, just like we see, in the car world. I mean, look at all the antique cars, classic cars out there with none of the technology that we're all used to having. People love to restore those, collect them, take them out on the roads. And that's been going on for decades. And I think we're going to see that in aviation too, where we'll see autonomous flight here probably within a decade. I think we'll be seeing autonomous flight with passengers, certainly with freight. And I'll still be flying my 1972 Bonanza around. for decades to come, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I guess finally on this, Dedalian has a YouTube channel, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes so that you can explore more about that company if you're interested. And the article does mention that before they get to the point of full cockpit autonomy, that there may be some benefits that come from the relationship of these companies. For example, enhancing classic flight deck instruments like collision avoidance systems, flight directors, and autopilots. So we might see some of the technology flow down to something nearer term than the fully autonomous cockpit.
You mean, Max, that you mean a UAV system benefiting manned flight? No, that would never happen in this universe.
Yeah, wait till Rob Mark finds about that.
Sorry, Tom, but us UAV guys need to stick up for all the years we put up with it. We're just going to fly into your windshields and kick you out of the sky.
Yeah, I gathered that might be a sensitive spot for you.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, we're talking with Tom Haines from AOPA. He's Editor-in-Chief, Senior Vice President of Media Communications and Outreach. And Tom, lately you've been taking a look at insurance premiums for pilots. What have AOPA members been telling you?
We've been hearing a consistent call volume and other communications, emails from AOPA members, and these are members flying everything from light piston airplanes and really particularly from like the owner-flown turbine market, where they're seeing dramatic increases over the last, particularly 6 months, increases in their premiums for hull and liability insurance. So we began looking into it. We've had numerous meetings with some of the executives of the underwriting companies to find out what's going on, what's causing this, because as you know, the safety record of general aviation has been trending downward for 20 years, is still doing very well. And so you'd think that would be a primary driver of insurance rates. You know, if accidents were going up, you could go, well, okay, I can understand why it is that we might be seeing these increases in general aviation for hull and liability insurance. But in fact, accident rate has continued to trend down. And although 2019 may have been a little bit of a blip from a fatality standpoint, it's still very good. And we don't think there's any kind of a trend there. We think it's maybe just a little bit of a blip, as you'll have when you've got a trend like that. So began having these conversations. And what we quickly determined was it's not really about what's going on in general aviation much, a little bit. But it's really related to the global insurance industry and all the things that we see in the news, hurricanes, tsunamis, fires, think of Australia, but also fires in the United States and all the damage in California. And the hurricanes that we've seen in the last few years have been devastating and very expensive for the insurance community. And then you throw in a couple of airline accidents like the 737 MAX and then a few GA accidents that have been very expensive, particularly in 2019. We had quite a few accidents where we had many people on the airplane. So the number of people killed in a particular accident was very high in a number of cases. So all those things coming together means that the insurance industry is suddenly very much under the gun to protect their reserves that they use to pay out in cases, big cases like this. And so they've really tightened the market. It's called a hardening of the market. We've had a soft market for about 12 years, which is pretty unprecedented. This insurance market tends to swing in, you know, 5 to 6 year increments, where we'll have a hard market for maybe a couple of years, and then it softens for about maybe 5 or 6 years. But in this case, we've had a soft market for about 12 years. And I've certainly seen that myself, and I don't know, Max, what your experience and with your customers, what you're hearing, but my Bonanza, a six-seat airplane, after about a decade of flat to, in a couple of cases, declining in insurance premiums, this past August ticked up 9% out of nowhere.
Okay.
Nothing changed, and you know, arguably, I'm more experienced with it than I was a year earlier, because I've one more year and, you know, 100 hours or so more experience. And yet I saw a 9% increase, which for me is, you know, a few hundred bucks, not the end of the world. But you take an owner-flown turbine pilot who's flying, you know, maybe a $3 or $4 million light jet. And in those cases, those guys are not seeing a 9%. They're typically seeing 20% to 40% is not uncommon. And in a few cases where there has been a change with what's going on with the pilot, they're seeing maybe as much as 100, or even one insurance provider noted that he had a customer saw 110% increase. In some cases, that even means comes with a lower liability limit than what they've been enjoying in the past. So lots going on there, and it's really just this tightening of the market kind of across the board is what's causing this.
Max, are you seeing the same thing?
Yeah, I'm wondering if the increasing hull values are part of it. If you look at what's happened over the last 10 years, we've moved away from a market with lots of lower cost piston aircraft to a market that's now got probably a higher percentage of expensive turboprops, expensive light jets, and now suddenly the losses can be quite significant. And I had comments over the Christmas holidays. An acquaintance of mine bought a Phenom 300, one of the brand new ones. And I think that's probably up in the $10 million category. And he was kind of surprised to discover that it's almost impossible to get insurance to fly that single pilot anymore, even though it's a single pilot jet. So I think insurers are just looking at the losses and saying, hey, you know, the two pilot record in general is better than the single pilot record. And we don't want to have to write off $10 million.
Yeah, no, that my conversations with these insurance executives, and I've talked to a bunch of them the last few weeks, is that's definitely a part of it. You know, used to be you didn't have any million-dollar single-engine piston airplanes, and now from Cirrus and Beechcraft and some others, you can get there pretty easily. And so then you start talking about the percentage of the fleet that is now taken up by things like TBM, you know, 940s and Pilatus PC-12s and light jets in the CJ category and the Phenom, as you point out. And so those are all, you know, the three to maybe $10 million airplanes. And much of that category didn't exist 20 years ago. And so it is definitely impacting what it is that insurers are paying out now that some of them are having accidents. One of the executives quoted something to me, something to the effect of, you know, we are selling to you a product that we don't know yet how much it costs.
Yes, which makes it difficult if you're in that business.
I'm being really good. I'm keeping my mouth shut.
You know, David, the ex-insurance industry guy, and maybe you can address this, David. I mean, to what extent – well, I think some people might think or assume that insurance companies sort of segment their business. So the aviation people, you know, cover that segment, pay for that segment. The boating, the maritime customers would have their rates set on their exposures and so forth. But it doesn't completely work that way, right, David? I mean,
no, I mean, you could have a catastrophic loss that could affect multiple segments. You could have a complete hull loss due to a hurricane or a complete hull loss due to a flood, right? It had nothing to do with the airplane flying. It had nothing to do with the piloting, but that aircraft is a total loss because a tornado came ripping down the runway and took out the aircraft. And the other part about aviation is insurance is laws of numbers. The more people you have insured and the more things you have insured, the bigger your pool is to support higher risk people. Every state in the union has, for all intents and purposes, has a high risk bucket for auto drivers. You know, the ones that go have had multiple DUIs or multiple driving tickets, right? They're, by law, they need to have insurance. So a lot of times states have a pool for those high risk. I don't think there's a high risk aviation pool out there. You know, yes, someone who's flying aerobatics, their insurance is going to be substantially higher than someone who's flying their Cessna 172. But I mean, it's laws of numbers. And like we've already said, we've gotten away from escorts, Ford escorts, and cars that just go back and forth to work, i.e. a Cessna 150, to high-end BMWs and Maseratis and Teslas, which are Phenoms or Vision Jets or, you know, those kind of aircraft where you have people have access to those aircraft much quicker than they did probably 20 years ago, you know, or even 10 years ago, which would cause a reevaluation over time to what the numbers say. You know, I mean, think about this. In the last 4 months, how many new Vision jets has Max Trescott flown off of the Cirrus line? That's
I can tell you in the last month, all of them. No, I'm kidding, not
really. I mean, but seriously, that's a higher end product that we didn't have 5 years ago, you know, that we have to ensure. And not everybody is going to be Max Trescott skills as piloting, you know, and it's going to be that kind of market. And hardening market is, there's a lot of these companies that do not want to fund GA anymore. And they are having to still make a profit and keep their totals up for precisely a catastrophic failure. You know, God forbid an airplane flies into a large building in New York, you know, not as a terrorist attack or anything, but just as an accident. You lose the airplane, you lost the pilot, you've lost the damage to the building. God forbid the building collapses. All of those things are involved with analysis, you know. I mean, how many safe hours is that pilot flying? Are they keeping up their minimums? You know, are they getting their 10 to 15 hours a week or month in to keep their flying skills up to date? All of that gets factored in by a bunch of accountants and accrual majors and thrown into spreadsheets to come up with a premium total.
So, Tom, how can pilots respond to this this environment that we find ourselves in right now?
Yeah. Well, great question. And there are a number of things pilots can do to help mitigate the increases. You're going to see increases for the next couple of years, certainly over the next 12 months, maybe 18 months. And then the anticipation is that it'll flatten out for a year or so, and then we'll probably get back into a somewhat softer market because some companies that have exited now, we're down from about 20 companies a year or so, go down to about 14 or 15 companies. And some of them will probably come back, or some new entrants will show up and we'll see a softer market again. But in the meantime, what you can do is, for one thing, just what David was talking about, you can train to something better than the FAA minimums and make sure that your underwriter is aware of that through your broker, and you're demonstrating to him that you're going to fly with somebody like Max Trescott, or that you are taking a BPPP course if you're a Bonanza or a BPT course, or that you're taking some other really type-specific training. And if you do that, you demonstrate to the insurance companies, you give them comfort, let them know that you're a better risk than somebody who doesn't do those kinds of things, and therefore you'll likely enjoy a better premium than the other guy. The other thing you can do is maintain the relationship with the same company if at all feasible. Don't be changing carriers to save $100, because that could come back to bite you in a tightening market, a hardening market. The other thing is, for older pilots, you may have to consider going to a simpler airplane. If you've been flying a twin, or even a retractable gear single, the insurance companies, as you age, and typically it's somewhere around about 75 years of age, when you get to that age, the insurance companies are going to look fondly on the idea that you're going to a simpler, slower airplane. So stepping down from a Bonanza to a fixed gear Cessna 182, for example, is something that they would really favor, and your premium would definitely reflect that. We have heard cases here at AOPA in the last week or so from a couple of fellows in their late 70s who have been flying, in one case, a Bonanza, an A36, for many years, feels very comfortable in it, and was told flat out by his underwriter that they would not insure him in that airplane, and that he would need to go to something simpler, or at least have a safety pilot with them at all times. Doesn't make sense always, because he may well be safer in something in a Bonanza that he's got many hours in than a 182. But apparently the insurance underwriters have had serious, really serious problems with older pilots and landing gear. It just happens more routinely than most of us hear about, because those typically don't get reported to the NTSB as an accident. And so the insurance companies tend to hold on to their claims data very carefully and aren't willing to share it, so that people can, like our Air Safety Institute, can do a lot of analysis and then perhaps create better training opportunities for pilots. So the insurance companies tend to hold on to that. We've been talking to them about maybe releasing that to us, the Air Safety Institute, and then we could do some analysis on that. So far, and there's some interest in that, by the way, so we may actually get to that. But for now, older pilots, you should be prepared to make some changes in the way you fly if you want to get any kind of reasonable premiums as you sort of tread past that about 75-year mark.
All right. And you talk a lot about this in the article that you have published, and we'll be sure to put a link to that in the show notes. I think probably a number of AOPA members have probably already seen it, but if not, you'll be able to find it there. And it's good resource.
Yeah, and I'm looking at several more articles kind of in the pipeline over the next couple of months, probably, dealing with different segments of the insurance market. I'll be looking specifically at the owner-flown turbine market. Those are ones being highly, highly impacted. Those of us flying simpler single-engine piston airplanes actually are seeing the smallest increases. Like I said, mine's about 9%. It's more like typically about 10% for those guys. But as I said earlier, it's, you know, if you're flying a single-pilot turbine airplane, and certainly if you're flying at single pilot, you can see 40, 50, 60%. That's pretty routine.
Great. All right. Well, any other interesting things going on at AOPA there in Frederick, Maryland? Are we having regional events again this year, and have they been established yet?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking. Those are always a great time, and we're always glad to have Max Trescott helping us out as a presenter at many of the locations. We're going to be in San Marcos, Texas at the end of May, last weekend in May. It's the weekend after Memorial Day, which is still May, believe it or not. And we'll be down there for 2 days on that Friday and Saturday. And we're a little bit different for this particular show. We're actually joining up with Go Wheels Up Texas, which is a music festival, an air show, and a car show that launched in 2019. And they're at the airport. And so we're going to go back there. It's actually the location of the very first regional fly-in that we did back in 2014. And so we're going back there and sort of teaming up with them to bring a really multifaceted experience. There'll be a lot of general public there because of the other events, but typical AOPA member attendees will have all the usual things that you've come to expect from one of our regional fly-ins, like workshops and seminars, aircraft displays, exhibitors. We've got our Friday night party called the Flight Line Cookout with a drone show, and also with a short takeoff and landing exhibition or invitational. So that's all happening in San Marcos, Texas. And then just a few weeks later, in the middle of June, we're up in Casper, Wyoming, which is a very different location for us. It's a pretty small town, but an incredible location. And we're hoping that people in the Mountain States in particular will come out and join us there, and also kind of in the Midwest. And then we'll take some time off while we all go to Oshkosh and do some of the other summer fun flying things that we do. And in September, we'll get back together again in the middle of September in Rochester, New York, where we'll have another fly-in up in that neck of the woods. And that's always a great area to be in because we've got so many pilots in the 250 or 300-mile radius of Rochester. And should be a lot of fun. Beautiful fall weather, we hope, by the middle of September. It should be good.
All right. And where do we find these on the AOPA website?
So you'll be able to find the locations and a lot more information about the 2020 locations. Around February 1st, we'll be putting the web pages up, and you can find the registration, all that sort of thing. And that'll be at aopa.org/flyin. Just go there, and like I said, around February 1st, and should have all the information you need about how to go to these events and what you can do there. And we've got the maps out there and some of the events that will be happening around each of those events. And as you come back in the next couple of months, we'll have for each of those locations, we'll have fly outs so that if you are interested in coming to one of these events, flying to these events, we'll have some organized places you can go sort of around the region and explore those areas by air as well. So lots of things going on over the next few months if you keep checking back on the website.
Excellent. Excellent, Tom. Any other initiatives or projects at AOPA that you'd like to make sure our audience is aware of?
Well, sure. We're always anxious to talk about the You Can Fly program here at AOPA. It's something that we've been working really hard on as a way to continue to increase the pilot population and not only get new pilots in, but there are elements of the You Can Fly program that help bring existing pilots back into the fold. But the one that really excites me, I think, the one component of You Can Fly is the high school curriculum. We have been developing STEM-based aviation curriculum for several years now, and it's out for ninth graders and 10th graders. The 11th grade product is in testing now and will be available by this fall, and the next school year starts, and then the 12th grade one will be tested and will be available by the time the following year after that. So people who are ninth graders or kids who are ninth graders a couple years ago, by the time they get to be seniors, will have had 4 years of this curriculum that talks all about the opportunities in aviation and what it is that you can do from a career standpoint. And we now are in 161 schools in 34 states, and it's free to any school that wants it. We just are providing it through our donors, the generosity of our donors. And the incredible thing that I find is the diversity of the kids who are taking this course. You know, as you guys know, about 96%, 95% of the pilot population is male. And we have about 23% of the kids in these classrooms are females. Just a remarkable swing. And the same thing with the typical underrepresented sort of populations, minorities and that sort of thing. It's a double-digit number of those as well. And we've got schools of all types. There are inner-city schools that have these in some really challenging locations. I think inner city Detroit, for example, is one. We've got several locations there. And then in the, you know, high-end schools, wealthy schools, Montgomery County just south of us is one of the wealthiest counties in Maryland, for example. And they just can't – they fill up the classes every time they open a new one up. And they've got several schools in Montgomery County offering two and three of these programs in the same school because they fill them up. It's pretty amazing what's going on and very exciting to see this and think about the impact that we might have as we grow this thing over the next couple of years to get more and more kids involved. So pretty exciting. And we're also doing a lot of flight clubs or flying clubs. We've started 135 flying clubs in the last few years, and we do support for flying clubs across the country to form and get access to airplanes. Flight training program. We're helping flight schools be more effective in getting and keeping student pilots and offering them marketing courses and other programs to help them just be better flight schools, as well as recognizing flight instructors who do it well across the country and giving them recognition. And then we've got the Rusty Pilot Program, which, as I said, bringing back some of the half a million or so people out there who have a pilot certificate who are no longer active. And we've been successful in putting about 7,600 pilots back into the air. And the fascinating thing about this is the number of them who have went on to not only just kind of tepidly get back into flying, but who have also then went on to buy airplanes. At our Tullahoma fly-in last fall, I ran into two different people who had went on to buy airplanes after being out of aviation for years, attending a Rusty Pilot program. One guy bought a tri-pacer and flew it all the way from New Mexico to Tennessee as part of the program. And I ran into a husband and wife who are both pilots. They took a Rusty Pilot program. She first got really excited about it, convinced him to do it. He did. And they went out and bought a Bonanza. And perfect. They'd flown it to the fly-in. And that's just a couple of examples of numerous I've had where people have gotten so excited about getting back into aviation that they went out and bought airplanes. So it's really rewarding.
Well, this might be a good time to reiterate something that Bene Wilson explained to me many years ago at the National Air and Space Museum, which is that you don't have to be an aircraft owner or a pilot in order to belong to AOPA. And that's my case. And if you if listen to some of these things that maybe you can relate to personally, or if you just like to support all the programs that AOPA is involved in, some of them that Tom just explained, as well as the advocacy that AOPA does for pilots and for aviation, you might want to consider joining. And also, we could mention that a couple of years ago, AOPA created a membership category for drone pilots, for unmanned aircraft. So there's actually a place for you in AOPA if most of your interest is in flying drones or being involved in that segment of aviation.
Well, I mean, I think we should really be fair. If you're interested in flying, you should be a member of AOPA.
Thank you. I agree.
All right. Tom, thanks so much for taking the time to come and speak with us and our audience. I know you've got a lot of things going on. Are you going to be at Sun and Fun this year?
Oh, you bet. Yeah, I'll be there.
Look forward to
catching up with you guys.
All right. We'll see you down there. Thanks again, Tom.
Hey, yeah, thanks so much for the opportunity to be on the program again with you. I really enjoy it and look forward to the next time.
What's up with the geeks? Max Trescott, what's up with you?
Well, it's been an unusual last 4 or 5 weeks. I've logged about 75 hours in the Vision Jet, or I should say in a variety of Vision Weeks.
Vision Weeks?
Or I should say in a variety of Vision Jets. And so I'm going to talk about some of those experiences this week in episode 136 of the Aviation News Talk podcast. Specifically, I'm going to talk about what it was like bringing a Vision Jet into Chicago O'Hare. I think I talked in the past about departing O'Hare, but arriving was kind of interesting. And I was the left seat guy for that. And I would have been just me in the airplane, but I wisely brought someone else along because I really had my hands full at one point. But that was quite exciting to go there. But, you know, I found something that was even more challenging than landing at O'Hare, and that's been trying to depart from some of the airports in Southern California. I'm going to go ahead and read the full clearance I got for an IFR departure for a 100-mile flight to Santa Barbara, and it's ridiculous. I mean, it's just incredibly long, convoluted. It involves changing directions essentially 4 times. You know, we departed to the west, then we went to the south, then we went to the east, then to the northwest, and finally to the west again. And, you know, all of this really looks like it was 1950s kind of clearance with VORs and radials and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm just going to appeal in this episode to the FAA to please bring those departures into the 21st century. I mean, it's absurd that we've got.
Is it noise abatement?
No, I don't think so. I think it's partially because they're close by airports. It's partially because there's high terrain to the north. And so I think that, you know, many, many, many years ago, this was the way to get out. But I think there's just got to be a better way. Because I was going to say that I was tearing my hair out, but as you know, I have very little hair left. But it's been interesting because the mix of flying that I'm doing has changed quite a bit. In the past, you know, flying the Cirruses, been flying, you know, mostly VFR, mostly in and out of airports that I'm very familiar with. And now I'm flying out IFR out of airports that I'm less familiar with. And I'm just amazed at how complex at least a couple of the clearances have been that I've gotten. So I'm going to be talking about that. Also going to talk about some recent high-profile accidents and also about a number of aviation rules of thumb. I mean, every industry has their rules of thumb. There are lots of them in aviation. So that's what we're talking about this week.
All right. Very good. Recently, we were talking about fuel dumping in the context of the Delta flight that returned to the airport after dumping fuel over a populated area. And we got a recording from Launchpad Marzari, who reminded me of something that I'd forgotten about. So here's Launchpad.
Hi, Max. Launchpad here. In the last episode, you mentioned that the FAA reported that 6 planes in the previous year had dumped fuel. You forget, your reporter at large was on one of those planes and took video. We were headed to Europe, and before we could enter the Atlantic tracks, we had to have two working airspeed indicators. The backup airspeed indicator failed before we entered the Atlanta tracks. We had to turn back to Atlanta. To do that, we had to dump close to 40 tons of fuel. Now, to our listeners, this fuel gets dumped on both wings simultaneously, and don't think gas nozzle like at the gas station. Think 3-inch fire hose, as you can see from the video. We're at an altitude of about 32,000 feet. When you drop fluid from that altitude, as it falls, the air resistance will cause the fluid to break apart from being in a solid stream into raindrops. It'll further, as it falls, the wind resistance will cause it to turn into mist. Then it'll start evaporating. Now, let's not get into a whole conversation about when it evaporates, because that involves dew point and what kind of fluid it is. But needless to say, jet fuel will evaporate probably before it even gets to 10,000 feet, so it never touches the ground. And this is the skill that aerial firefighters have to work with. Dump the fuel too low, and you're just slamming water into the target, and the weight of the water is doing more damage than the fire was. Drop it too high, and it's light rain or mist, and also doesn't affect the fire. But that's an interview for another day. We're talking about dumping fuel. Dumping fuel at altitude? Not a problem. Dumping fuel as you approach for landing? Yeah, that could get sticky. Just hope you enjoy the video. This is your reporter at large. Frequency change approved.
Yeah, thanks for that launch pad. I'll at least have a screenshot from the video in the show notes. The video itself, you know, we should put that up on the extremely sparse Airplane Geeks YouTube channel, if someone can explain to me how to do that, because I don't know how to do that. So at least have a screenshot. It's dramatic, and the video is especially dramatic.
You don't have a 12-year-old there who can help you with that?
No, I don't.
Everyone needs a 12-year-old for tech support.
I know. I think we should do more videos, maybe we need someone to volunteer to be our YouTube guru and organizer of things video for Airplane Geeks. If anyone is able to step up and fill that role, that might be kind of interesting. And being able to do that might encourage us to create more videos.
You know, I think Launchpad raised an interesting point, which is if you're up in the flight levels, you're at a faster speed and a higher altitude, both of which are going to help break that fuel up. I mean, this aircraft we were talking about last week, I think, was at 2,000 feet. And when you're that low and you're the Class Bravo, you're going to certainly be doing less than 250 knots. And if he's on final to LAX, my guess is he's less than 200 knots. So that's going to be a lot less of force from the wind to break that up. So, yeah, I would imagine it really did come down as a pretty ugly, sticky mess.
Yes, yes. On the topic of fuel dumps, we got an email from our friend Rob in Perth, who said that we might be interested in an episode, speaking of YouTube. There's a channel called Mentor Pilot, and he's got a video, Fuel Dump Over Los Angeles, Why? And it's just a 15-minute video, but he explains some of the same things that Launchpad did, and it can be another interesting source to learn more about fuel dumping. One of the things he said in there that I found particularly impressive is that a Boeing 777 can shed between 1.4 and 2.5 tons of fuel per minute. So Launchpad talked about a fire hose. It's that's definitely what we're looking at here, I think. And then speaking of listener mail, we also heard from Sean, and he's responding to our conversation about GPS jamming exercises by the military. We talked about that. He says, I take issue with the idea that the solution to GPS jamming is to, quote, keep your skills up. The FAA, he says, is increasingly pressing for a national airspace system that is heavily reliant on GPS, going so far as to make it functionally illegal for GA aircraft to operate in various airspace without an operating GPS via the ADS-B out mandate, and fairly rapidly decommissioning ground-based nav aids. So he writes, on the flip side, we have military agencies routinely performing GPS jamming for practice, seemingly as if it's no big deal. Whether the military needs to run drills like this is somewhat irrelevant, in the same way that we don't allow the military to practice cutting out the power grid. Critical services cannot be messed with outside a genuine emergency. I believe it is only a matter of time until one of these exercises results directly or indirectly in a serious incident, after which the rules will change and GPS will be treated, as it should, as a critical service, which cannot be messed with outside a real emergency. So Sean says, my hope is that we can collectively come to our senses on this before such an incident occurs. But as long as the general feeling is that pilots just need to suck it up and practice more, I'm afraid the more likely outcome is the less desirable one. He says, thanks for your terrific podcast. And that's from Sean in Portland. I think GPS is a critical resource. I mean, if you think about all the GPS-enabled stuff that we do each day, if the GPS system were to go down or someone were to take it down or someone were to interfere with it, I think everything would stop. Nobody would know how to get to where they're going. I think all commerce would end. It would just be a disaster. It'd be as bad as the power going out.
I think you're right. I think it is really looked at as a utility these days, a service that you expect to, you know, operate at 99.99% uptime, and for which when you have interruptions, it really is incredibly inconvenient. I mean, just think how Uber and Lyft and all these ride services would probably come to a screeching halt. And that's just one of, you know, many examples. You know, I was thinking about how a week ago I misplaced my phone. I was sure happy to have the Find Me function, you know, to help locate that telephone. And again, these are just, you know, tiny, tiny little examples. You look at all the freight companies that are tracking not only individual containers, but entire ships. Yeah, there are there are massive container ships at sea that now totally rely on GPS for navigation. So, yeah, its use is pervasive, and it's extended its way into our economy in ways that I think the creators of GPS back in the 1980s when they were designing these satellites just could not have possibly envisioned.
And how are you going to track your pet chihuahua down in the hold in his luxury $800 crate if there's no
And just to be clear to all listeners, I do not have a pet chihuahua.
Do you have any pets?
We do have a
cat. Oh, you have a cat, right?
We have a couple of cats. You've seen them go by on the, video here. They occasionally help me with podcasting. They're really a big help.
That's good. All right. Well, we had a good airline story of the week last time, and we heard from a couple folks. One was Mark Newton, who sent us a good airline story of the week. It's a little bit long, but Mark gave us a good story here. He says, I flew to Switzerland for a work trip in December. Business class return ticket. Routed Sydney to Singapore to Heathrow to Zurich on British Airways. I got caught up in the recent French industrial action. Due to an air traffic control strike, my flight from Zurich to London to start my homeward journey was delayed. My booking had plenty of time between arriving in London and departing for Singapore, but as the minutes ticked by, my margin was disappearing. You probably know how it feels when you're not sure if you're going to make a connection. One part of your brain is assured that the airline will find a way to make it work. Another part is contemplating the consequences of a delay. A third part imagining that a delay on a long-haul flight could lead to the inconvenience of an overnight stop at an airport hotel with baggage unavailable because it's been checked through to the final destination. Flashbacks to 4 years ago when American Airlines gave me an unexpected overnight stop in Dallas when it was 38 degrees Fahrenheit, wearing shorts and a T-shirt and flip-flops with all my luggage checked through to the Caribbean.
And by the way, I've arrived before in Dallas when it's 38. 38 doesn't sound bad, but when the wind is blowing 20 knots, that's really cold.
Yes, especially in shorts and a t-shirt.
Yeah.
So you can imagine, he says, I'm running scenarios through my head and preparing for a tiring 26-hour journey to blow out to a 36-hour train wreck as I'm boarding my flight nearly 2 hours after its scheduled departure time. The crew announces the ETA for Heathrow about 30 minutes before my Singapore flight leaves. Tight, but perhaps possible if the stars align. We're arriving at Heathrow Terminal 5, same as my departing flight. They're both using gates on the A pier, and I'm at the head of all the queues, and I run. There might be enough time to run through transit security screening and reach my outbound A380 right before the door closes. Just as an aside, years ago I had one of those dashes. I told this story a long, long time ago. I had one of those dashes, tight connection. This was pre-9/11, and I came up to a we had arrived. I was dashing through the airport to get to my departure gate to try to make the flight. This was a business trip, so you don't really want to miss your flights on a business trip. And there was a X-ray machine that I had to go through, that we all had to go through. And there was a gentleman in a wheelchair entering or coming close to that X-ray machine. And everything was stopping because how are they going to get this wheelchair through and all that? I actually vaulted over the guy in his wheelchair to get ahead of him in line and dash through the X-ray machine. Now, you couldn't do that post 9/11, I don't think. But I made it. I made the flight. But the surprising thing was, I'm not a very athletic guy, and the surprising thing was being able to, you know, to long jump over this guy in a wheelchair. But all right, anyway, back to the story. So he says, I call a flight attendant and explain, finishing with, can you find out our arrival gate and the departure gate for my onward flight? Not yet. Not everything has been allocated yet, but she'll let me know. I chew nervously on the short-haul snack sandwiches with the crust cut off and some scones with jam and clotted cream, precisely as British as you'd expect from British Airways. Later in the flight, the attendant returned. Excuse me, Mr. Newton. Terribly sorry to disturb you, but I'd like to reassure you that we'll do our best. A gentleman will meet you when we arrive and help you with your onward arrangements. Imagine it said in the accent, again, exactly as British as you'd expect. We land, and I'm one of the first people off the plane. Standing near the jetway control panel is a man in a British Airways uniform holding a sign with my name on it. He asks if he can see my passport, checks it, and requests that I follow him. He led me through the door at the airplane end of the jetway, which opened onto a stairway that descended to the ramp. A car was parked at the bottom of the stairs, with the driver standing by its door, ushering me into the back seat. We started driving across the ramp, occasionally stopping to give way to passing Boeing 777s. The man who met me explained that they're from BA Premium Service, and they're going to help me make my connection. Then he phoned a control room to tell them he'd pick me up and was on time. The car stopped at the south end of the T5C pier, and the driver opened my door. My escort ushered me into a building and down a corridor deep in the bowels of the undercroft beneath the public areas of the terminal. I had to look up undercroft. I'll let you do that yourself. Past immigration police, interview rooms, doorways with baggage conveyors humming noisily on the other side, break rooms and medic stations. Eventually, we reached a small room with a baggage X-ray machine, a metal detector, and an airport body scanner. I had to wait briefly while it booted up. They'd turned it on just for me. Nobody gets through an airport without security screening, and this room was the one they'd prepared for this specific eventuality. Passport scanned, backpack on the X-ray conveyor, no liquids or gels, pockets empty, step to the scanner, same as every other airport scan, but somehow personal. Having attended to the formalities, I collected my belongings and we backtracked to the car. I overheard my escort making another phone call. Yes, we're proceeding now. Mr. Newton is already checked in. Can you board him now, please? The invisible operator at the other end of the line was keying in the same database entry that would have been created if my boarding pass barcode had been scanned at the gate. The car arrived and parked next to the nose gear of an A380. My escort ushered me into an elevator, which ascended and opened onto the jetway. We've made it. This is my plane. I could have hugged the guy. I was so relieved, but a display of emotion like that would make the British call the cops. So I remained stoic, shook his hand with awed and profuse thanks, then retreated down the jetway, greeted the cabin crew, and found my seat. The plane's door was closed before I even sat down. So, Mark writes, I spent the next 26 hours in flight mode, so I didn't get the SMS that regretfully informed me that the transfer was too quick for my luggage, which missed the flight. But it didn't matter. They put it on another plane, and it caught up during my Singapore transfer. It was on the same carousel with all the other bags when I reached Sydney. Customer service isn't about whether things screw up. Customer service is about the response when the screw-up is imposed upon you. British Airways absolutely excelled. I've never received any kind of customer service from anyone, much less an airline, as good as I received on that December night. Without any expectation that it would happen at all, everything ran like clockwork. Sustained applause to everyone involved. And that's from Mark. Quite a story. I think that's pretty interesting. Pretty cool.
Yeah, and of course, Mark is from Australia, so I'm guessing he doesn't fly British Airways so often that he's got their, you know, top-tier, you know, membership. I mean, this sounds like a service they provided for somebody who wasn't necessarily one of their top customers.
Yeah, it's just excellent. A great way to build loyalty, customer loyalty, for sure.
And it was on a December night. It almost sounds like a Christmas story.
I know. Yeah. Mark, just quickly, Mark, because it's worth mentioning, Mark wrote in another email about the three firefighters who lost their lives in a Coulson C-130 crash that was near Coma in the bushfire fighting operations in Australia. And there's an ABC Australia news article that Mark passed along. I'll put that in the show notes. He says the plane just completed a retardant drop. Disappeared from radar, and conditions at the time were dire. Get this, temperatures over 110 degrees Fahrenheit, gusty turbulent winds and building thunderstorms. Several fires had built rapidly during the day, spreading towards towns, flames over 50 feet high. The scene of the crash, total devastation, wreckage spread over about half a mile of forest and pasture. And so the deceased crew were Captain Ian Macbeth, First Officer Paul Hudson, and Flight Engineer Rick DeMorgan, Jr. They'll be honored with a state memorial next month. And Mark also says, to give you a sense of scale, the recent California wildfires, which were pretty extensive, burned approximately 675 hectares. The fires in Australia so far have burned more than 14 million hectares. Yeah, that's really tragic. It's as we record this, it's only late January, and the Australian fire season usually runs through till April. So we have a lot more potentially to come.
And I ran the math on that. That's a little more than 20 times larger. So that's wow. It's hard for me to imagine. I mean, those fires were so devastating here in California. I just can't imagine, you know, what 20 times that amount of fire would be like. And, you know, 110 degrees, it's one thing to think about what that might be like if you were on the ground. But imagine if you're in the cockpit of a fire bomber, which probably doesn't have air conditioning up front. I think the environment must be incredibly difficult for these firefighting crews. So anyway, they're facing challenges that most of us, you know, never have to face. So thank goodness they're willing to go up and, you know, do what they do. And sad, of course, that sometimes they, you know, don't come back safely.
Yep. Yes. I remembered when the U.S. firefighters arrived in Australia, there was a spontaneous applause at the airport from the locals. And, you know, I think that characterizes, you know, the Australian people, but, you know, also the, you know, the support for the firefighters and, you know, the gratitude for the help that they're receiving And so it's terrible that three of those folks won't be coming back home. We'll close out with another positive airline story. This will be much shorter. This was from Kyle. And he said, my wife and I take a trip with her family every year. This year we went to Maui for a week, flying from Minnesota to Maui with a layover in Oakland on Southwest Airlines. My wife's brother took this trip to paradise as an opportunity to propose to his girlfriend of 2 years. Of course, she said yes. Good thing, huh? And we all were very excited to have her join the family. On our way back to Minnesota, she was chatting with the gate agent in Oakland about our flight and mentioned that they just got engaged in Hawaii. The gate agent took this as an opportunity to show them some love and informed the flight attendants, Charisse and Frank, who not only gave the happy couple a free bottle of champagne, but also congratulated them and sang to them over the intercom. Oh, Kyle says, I want to thank the friendly Southwest Airlines staff and especially Charisse for making our last leg home a special one. And Kyle closes, we can't wait to fly Southwest for our next family trip. There you go.
You got to love Southwest.
Yeah, it's funny, though. The hearing Southwest in Hawaii just doesn't yet seem right.
Not used to it yet, huh?
Yeah, it's only been a few months.
It sounds like it's like Southwest in the Caribbean and international travel. It just doesn't register right yet.
Yeah, they had to get some special ETOPS outfitting for their 737s that are on that particular route because you can't use the standard domestic one. So, yeah, a lot of work goes into opening up new routes like that. I was on Southwest 2 weeks ago, I think, to Burbank. I'll be on them again on Wednesday to head back to Southern California to meet up with a client there. So they provide great service.
I have never flown on Southwest. I don't even know how that's possible.
Well, that's because you drive so much. That's why.
That's why it's possible. Yeah.
Every time we talk to you, you're driving somewhere.
But in all fairness, Max, when you were doing all your traveling, you were a globe traveler and you were not flying the southwest of the United States.
No. Yeah, you're right. No, it was all international travel, either across the Atlantic or the Pacific. Yeah. Never had an opportunity to fly Southwest. All right. Well, maybe we'll change that someday. I hope so. Meantime, we want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Tom Haines, a great guy, by the way, AOPA Editor-in-Chief and Senior Vice President of Media Communications and Outreach. It's always a pleasure to have Tom. Look forward to seeing him at Sun and Fun and the rest of the AOPA crew. Boy, they were out in force at Sun and Fun last year, I remember. They had a lot of really good seminars and events and things. I'm sure they'll do that again. And of course, EAA was also out in force at Sun and Fun last year, and I'm sure they'll be there as well. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Look for the show notes for this episode. And if you want to go straight to those, they're at airplanegeeks.com/588. You can reach us on email. We're at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right. David Vanderhoof, where do we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on Facebook at David Vanderhoof. You can find me on our Slack listener team. And you can do that by sending us an email to feedback@.
That's the other show.
This is becoming a running joke, folks, because I screw this up on every show now, because no matter what show it is, I'm doing the other one. And you can send us a request to join our Slack listener team by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll send you an invite to join our Slack listener team. And, of course, you can find me on Friday mornings talking about drones on that show with Max Flight called the UAV Digest.
Great. And Max Trescott, you're up.
Well, I'd encourage folks to come out to Instagram. I have been posting a whole series of photos entitled 8 Days of Flying the Cirrus Vision Jet. And I've actually had a couple hundred people join just in the last couple of weeks. So putting up probably, you know, 8-9 photos every week. So check that out. Go out to Instagram and just follow Aviation News Talk, all one word, of course. And if you want to shoot me an email about anything, you can just send an email to aviationnewstalk@gmail.com.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com, and with Mary Kirby at PaxXPodcast.com. And I was serious, if any of you want to become the official Airplane Geeks YouTube master, I'm not sure what you call it. Let us
video
know.
Manager.
Video manager. Senior video manager. Associate, no. Video manager.
Associate video producer. How's that?
Oh, that's excellent, excellent. Because our YouTube channel is really pathetic. I think there's 3, maybe 4 videos on there. But it's, like I said, it's pretty pathetic. Maybe we can, you know, boost that up and do some more video work. Meantime, we'll ask that you please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.